I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome back to Radio Times. The derailment of train 188 on May 12th last year in Philadelphia was one of the worst accidents in Amtrak history. The train was going twice the speed limit when it rounded a curve in the track, and within a few seconds, it went off the rails. 8 people died and more than 200 were injured. The descriptions of passengers and crew tossed around inside the train cars are frightening, and the scene of carnage was horrifying. One key question that has haunted this accident is, why was the train going so fast? The National Transportation Safety Board released a trove of documents this week about the accident, including 2 interviews with the engineer Brandon Bostian. Our guest, Jonathan Tamari, has read some of those documents, and he joins us on Radio Times. He's a Philadelphia Inquirer's Washington correspondent, and he writes about lawmakers, policy, and politics affecting this region. And Jonathan Tamari, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
This is a docket that was released by the NTSB. They are not giving interviews about what is included in this docket. What is in here and what should people know about?
So it's more than 2,000 pages, and it's basically everything that these investigators are going to use as they try to come to some kind of conclusion about the probable cause of this accident and any safety recommendations they may make to improve response time, improve the what they call the survivability of a crash, in other words, making it safer going forward in case there is another incident like this. A lot of it is very technical. It's examinations of the track, of the signal, of the cab, the locomotive, the cars behind it. And then there are interviews with the crew members and, of course, the engineer, which was the thing that was the most revealing, even though it did not lead to any clear conclusions.
Well, let's talk about the interviews that they did with the engineer, Brandon Bostian. First of all, tell us a little bit about him. And he seems like a person who has been in love with trains, had a passion for trains ever since he was a young child.
Yes, I mean, according to people who knew him, this is something he was always interested in, always passionate about. He started working as an assistant at a railroad out in Missouri as an office assistant while he was still completing college. And he eventually worked his way up through different rail jobs. He worked in California for a time, came out to Amtrak in around 2010, became a certified engineer for Amtrak working out of New York. And again, his friends said that this is something he always loved. Crew members said he was attentive, he knew the job, he knew the speed limits, he was on time for meetings. He was 32 at the time of the accident, and there did not appear to be any red flags, at least in these documents, that show any problems leading up to this day.
And we're talking about whether there were drugs in his system or alcohol or whether he was on his cell phone. All that has been ruled out, Jonathan?
Drugs and alcohol have been ruled out. He was not using it on the cell phone. They've been very specific. He was not using it for calls, not using it for texting, not using it for data, so he wasn't surfing the web or anything like that. They have not been able to rule out whether he may have used an app, playing a game, using the calculator. But he has said very specifically, and his lawyer has said, that the phone was in his bag, that he was not using it at all.
And he had been on this is the Northeast Corridor, of course, the busiest corridor in Amtrak, in the system there. So he had been an engineer on this corridor for, what, a couple of weeks?
Yeah, on this particular route, it was roughly 2 weeks. Now, they say he had been working in the area of the accident for about 3 years or so, but this particular route, it was about 2 weeks.
And we're talking about a very specific part of this rail system, this curve that's in North Philadelphia. Can you describe that curve for us, Jonathan?
Well, in general, according to these documents, and again, these are Amtrak, these come from interviews with folks who work for Amtrak and investigators, they say that it's not actually a very complex area compared to some of the others along the route, including in Penn Station, around Penn Station in New York. But this particular stretch, the speed limit changes several times. It goes from 30 to 70 to 60, 80, 65, and then down to 50 when you get into that curve. So the speed limit is changing as you go through this area, and obviously the engineers, it's up to them to adjust as they go.
And he was going through this curve. It was, what, 106 miles an hour?
That's right. He reached 106 miles an hour as they approached this curve, and he hit the emergency brake about 3 seconds before they got into the curve, but it only got the train down to 103 miles an hour. So obviously going way too fast. And could not make it through the curve. And interestingly, people from Amtrak have said that if he was going 80, which is the speed limit shortly before the curve, that it could have made it through the curve. But they did not anticipate that someone would not only not slow down, but would in fact speed up from that 80-mile-an-hour stretch.
And the suggested speed limit is, what, 50? So he's going twice the speed limit.
Yes, more than twice the speed limit when they enter the curve.
So in this trove of documents, and there are these two interviews, what is his description of what happened as he was navigating this train through Philadelphia?
The interviews they provide a lot of detail in some areas and not as much detail at the very fateful moment where they actually get into this curve. And in fact, he questions his own memories repeatedly as he talks to the investigators, saying that he may have had a concussion after the accident and that he remembers it almost in a foggy state with very few images. What he does describe is a normal day right up until the point where he's traveling here past Philadelphia northbound. And he's in an area where the speed limit is 80, and he realizes that he's only going 70. And so he starts to speed up to go back up to 80 miles an hour. And then he approaches this curve, which he says to investigators can sneak up on you, that it's the kind of thing that you don't know. You know a curve is there, but you don't know you're in it until you're almost already in it, is what he told investigators. And so as they enter the curve, he realizes that they're going too fast. And he starts to apply the brakes and realizes they're going way too fast. And he applies the brakes more and eventually hits the emergency brakes, and it's too late. And he says that he then wakes up in the cab, standing in his cab, and the train has already derailed. He describes, you know, the moment where he says, this is it, we're going over. But nowhere in the interview does he say why they went from 80 to over 100, or if he did not realize where he was or what it was that made him keep going that fast and not slowing down before he reached that curve.
Was he injured in this derailment?
He suffered, again, he says he was diagnosed with, or not diagnosed, but was told at the hospital that he had a concussion. He had sprains, bruises, scrapes, but certainly nothing along the lines of what some of the most serious injuries are.
Now, what is the signaling like on this, or even the, I guess, traffic signals or whatever they're called in railroad parlance? So is this a well-marked area along the Amtrak corridor?
There was a sign signaling what the speed restriction is in that area, and it was in place and correct the night of the accident, according to these documents. Now, the engineer did tell investigators, though, that he did not typically look for those signs, that they were often wrong or they were for the wrong train. And so he largely went by memory, which I don't think is unusual for engineers. They are required largely to memorize the routes, memorize the land, the markers that you might pass, like an elevated bridge. There's an elevated SEPTA bridge there, and that is supposed to be a marker that you know you're starting to approach this curve. So they work a lot by visual signals that might not necessarily be like a speed limit sign, like when you're driving on a highway. And this is something that has stunned some members of Congress who have said, well, listen, if you drive your car, you have, even any car you buy today could have a GPS system in it, and it tells you where you are and exactly where you are on the road. And they're stunned that this does not exist in trains.
That's Jonathan Tamari, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He writes for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and we're talking about a report released earlier this week by the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, looking at that fatal May 12th Amtrak derailment in Philadelphia, so much in the news. And if you have any questions or comments, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHY. Radio Times. I'm curious then, Jonathan, there were two interviews that were done with the engineer, one shortly after the derailment and then one in November. Are there discrepancies there? And memory is a it can be a very strange and unreliable thing.
The biggest difference is that in the second interview, he remembered much, much more detail, which I don't think is very surprising. Now, some of the lawyers for victims have said that they have questioned his account because of this. The first interview was 3 days after the crash. The second interview is, it was roughly 6 months or so. It was in November. The crash was in May. He remembers a lot more detail the second time. He remembers speeding up from 70 to 80. He remembers the scene that he's looking at as they enter the curve. He remembers thinking, this is it, we're going over, we're going too fast. So there's more detail, but I don't think the fundamental account changes significantly, at least not that I've seen.
Does he have any explanation for why the train that he was driving was going 106 miles an hour? Does he have a theory about that?
He does not. He doesn't offer it. And there does not seem to be a point where that question was clearly asked, to be honest. I don't see any point where they say, why were you going 100 miles an hour, over 100 miles an hour? And maybe that's because he told investigators that he just doesn't remember very much. What he talks about is that he remembers accelerating from 70 to 80, and I don't remember anything from that point until after the train was already in the curve. That's a direct quote. So it's not clear why he kept going from 80 over 100. There are theories. There are theories from engineers and, again, some members of Congress that maybe he lost track of where he was, that there is another stretch of track a little while later where the speed limit increases to 110 miles an hour. So 106 would obviously be within that. But the NTSB has not come to any conclusions on that. These documents don't offer any opinion on that. And that probably we probably won't hear from them until sometime this spring.
And is that when they come out with a much more what I can't imagine being more detailed, but just sort of more information and perhaps recommendations?
Right. That's where they will take all the information that they just released. This is basically the factual basis of what they're looking at. And now they will go in and analyze it and say, based on their expertise and their knowledge of trains, this is probably what happened. And the investigators and staff will make a proposal, and then the NTSB, the board members themselves, will have to read over that proposal and either vote to accept it or reject it as the probable cause for this crash.
Jonathan, we're almost up on a break here, but Dave from Philadelphia wants to know whether the train was running late that day, May 12th.
I don't believe it was running late on this particular stretch. It had arrived on its southbound trip from New York to Washington. It had arrived there 30 minutes late, and so his normal hour-and-a-half break in Washington was cut down to an hour. But I don't believe that it was running late, or if it was, it was not significantly late on the northbound trip.
And again, that's Jonathan Tamari, and we are talking about The fatal derailment in Philadelphia. This was May 12th last year. An Amtrak train derailed on a very busy section of Amtrak. 8 people died. More than 200 were injured. And earlier this week, the National Transportation Safety Board released a trove of material, interviews, photographs, and related material to this derailment. And Jonathan Tamari has read through some of that and is giving us some of these findings. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Again, talking with Jonathan Tamari about this trove of documents called an accident docket released earlier this week by the National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB, about the fatal May 12th Amtrak train derailment in Philadelphia. 8 people died, more than 200 were injured, and it does include 2 interviews with the engineer Brandon Bostian. And it has left many questions unanswered, including literally, how did this happen? Again, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jonathan, there's some question about rocks being hurled at trains, and apparently that's a problem along this route and in this particular part of the Amtrak route as well. What do we know about whether this train was hit by a rock and if that in any way explains what might have happened?
investigators do not believe that the Amtrak train itself was hit by a rock or any kind of object. What is known is that there was an object that hit a SEPTA train in that very same area and shattered its windshield and forced that train to move off to the side and stop. And now there was radio communication from the SEPTA driver at that time about the incident, about something he thought maybe a rock, maybe something else, had hit that train. And Bastian, driving the Amtrak, or running the Amtrak train, becomes worried about this. He's worried. He says he's worried about his fellow engineer, whether he could be hurt from the glass damage. And he says he's worried that there could be SEPTA crews out on the track kind of inspecting the damage as he's coming through. This is about 5 minutes before he reaches the curve, according to these documents. And this is something that he describes as creating some confusion leading up to it. And there's a lot of radio communication going on between SEPTA and a dispatcher. And he wants everybody to know that he's coming through and I believe does not hear back from SEPTA to acknowledge that he is passing through as well. And this, he says, causes some worry for him. It's, again, it's about 5 minutes before the incident. But it's one of the many factors that goes into this, and you wonder if it caused a distraction or not. Again, there's no conclusions as to that, but it is something that has certainly been on people's minds since that night. There were reports that maybe the Amtrak train itself had been hit, but that does not appear to be the case.
Talk to us about positive train control, what that's supposed to do, and if any way this factors into what happened last May.
Well, it certainly factors in that the National Transportation Safety Board has said explicitly that if positive train control was in place on the tracks, it would have prevented this accident. This is a safety system that operates largely over radio waves that's been discussed really since the 1970s that can remotely stop or slow a train that is going too fast for the speed limit in that area. And it was required, Congress required it on all commuter railroads and major freight railroads in 2008 after another horrific crash out in Southern California. In 2008, Congress passes a law that says all these railroads have to have it in place by the end of 2015. Mm. Most railroads at that time, at the time of this crash, were way behind, not even close to getting it ready to at the end of 2015. Amtrak, ironically, is one of the few that was actually on target along the Northeast Corridor, at least, which is where this accident happened. But they were not required to have it in place yet in that May. And they had trouble acquiring the radio spectrum that's needed to operate this. They had just acquired it a month or two before, but they didn't, and they had equipment on the track, but they hadn't gone through the testing, the final installation process to actually have it up and working. At the end of last year, Amtrak did, in fact, turn positive train control on along almost the entire Northeast Corridor, all of the tracks that it owns. There's about a 56-mile stretch that's owned by another railroad in between New York and Connecticut where positive train control is not implemented yet. But along the Amtrak railroads, Amtrak rail and the Northeast Corridor, it is now working. Now, as part of the delay here, Congress actually has given railroads another 3 to 5 years to install it until 2018 and in some cases 2020. So most railroads around the country do not expect to have this in place now until 2018 or 2020, you know, 10 to 12 years after Congress mandated it.
But it is in this section where the train derailed now?
For Amtrak, yes, it is. And SEPTA is working to roll it out. They have said they expect to have it out within the early months of this year. New Jersey Transit does not expect to have it in place until 2018. But on Amtrak, yes, it is now in place where this accident happened.
Let me get Peter from Camden County to join us, and we have a second guest who will be joining us. Peter, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. How are you doing here?
Good.
Hi, folks.
Hi there.
I was wondering if there had been any talk about something that I noticed when I reviewed the facts after the accident occurred, namely that the tracks are banked at that curve so that they are structured to take a substantial amount of speed and, in effect, carry the centrifugal force of the train flying around the curve, and that even 106 miles per hour may have been insufficient to derail the train, except that if you also apply the brakes, it forces the train to kind of drip its way down the track. So in effect, it's airborne half the time. And that was the cause of the derailment. So that the engineer may have accidentally caused it to derail by putting on the brakes.
Well, Peter, just a quick question. Are you a train engineer yourself? You seem pretty knowledgeable.
Just my father was an engineer. I was kind of raised with the math, and I'm an attorney and would handle that kind of logic in some of the cases that I worked on.
Interesting. Jonathan, can you weigh in on that?
That is not something that I have heard. I think that is probably a little beyond my technical expertise. I think that's something certainly that the NTSB would, if that's a possibility, something that their investigators would review and that these documents would help them determine. Now, I do recall there was a hearing before the House Transportation Committee where they Amtrak executives were asked about this curve and asked about the speed, and they did say that you should be able to go through that curve at 80 miles an hour, the speed limit leading up to the curve, so that at 80 you could do it, but that above that it sounded like you're reaching into a derailment speed. So my impression from that hearing was that above 80 miles an hour or so is where you're going to start to get into a point where you're going to derail.
Peter, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We are talking about the derailment last May, May 12th, in fact, of an Amtrak train in Philadelphia. And 8 people died, more than 200 were injured. And earlier this week, the National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB released a trove of materials, interviews, reports, photographs about what happened on that fateful day here in Philadelphia. And again, Jonathan Tamari is with us. He writes for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Joining us now is Josh Gottbaum. He's a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution in Washington. In fact, he was a passenger on Amtrak 188 that day. He was injured, but he has a very unusual perspective. He has worked in government under 4 presidents. He also has experience with disasters, having been the founding CEO of the September 11th Fund. And he wrote a piece in Politico about what happened to him that day and to others on that train. And Josh Gottbaum, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be here, Marty.
Can I take you back to May 2015, about 9:30? You're in the third car doing some work on your way, up to New York?
Yep. On my way up to New York to give a speech, basically.
To give a speech. Did you mind talking about what happened that day?
Oh, no, I've written about it. I was minding my own business, doing what one does night on Amtrak, which is answering emails or playing games. And there was this incredibly loud screech. And so I looked up. I just thought it was, afterwards I realized, oh, maybe it was applying the brakes. But there was a really loud screech. I looked up, and the car is turning over.
Wow.
You know how, like on a roller coaster, things bank?
Yes.
And so my first reaction, since this is radio, I will clean it up slightly, was, holy cow, we could be turning over. And then I knew we'd left Philadelphia, so I was thinking, oh, my God, are we going to fall in the river or something like that, et cetera. Very quickly, the car turned on its side. The lights went out. We went into the dirt. Windows popped out, the seats, the force was so great that the seats came off the floor. And so what we obviously were thrown around. I was sitting and all of a sudden I was on what used to be the right side, except it was the floor with the person who'd been sitting next to me in my lap. And we were covered by seats, because they'd become disconnected from the floor. And so I first said, okay, am I dead? And didn't think so. It didn't feel exactly what I hoped heaven would be like. And was I injured? I didn't feel any broken bones. That turned out to be wrong. It turns out your first assessments aren't always the right ones. And I didn't see bleeding any place. And so I thought, I'm okay. I had lost my glasses and the thing, so I was fairly blind. And then I went through the same question with the young woman who was next to me. Are you okay? Anything broken?
Was
any
she
bleeding,
okay?
Et cetera.
Was she okay?
And then said, so let's figure out how to get out of here, because the car was on its side. We knew there was a risk of electricity, and people really were hurt. And so, first thing we did is people who had cell phones turned on their lights so that people could see, because it was pitch black, and the car was full of dust. And so, and then people tried to get out from under seats or get on top of seats, et cetera. There was a young man whom I later learned, his name was Alan Graham, who's a lot more nimble than I, who climbed up on the pile of seats to get to what had been the left side of the car, but was now the roof in effect, and pull open the emergency exit so that by climbing up on a pile of seats, you could get out of the car on what was now the roof, what had been the left side.
And what you were doing was helping people, what, up on these seats and then out the roof through
exactly.
A window?
Because there were, I mean, I was relatively lucky. There was a woman who was screaming because her arm had been cut very, very deeply and she was bleeding very badly. So we pushed her up and got her onto the roof. There was another whose arm was pretty clearly broken. It was hard to tell in the dark, but pretty clearly broken. So she had troubles. We pushed her up. Some people were trying to find their suitcases and things like that. And the first time I was really scared was when the car turned over, because I thought, holy cow, we could die.
Yeah.
That lasted about 10 seconds, because within 10 seconds, we were on our side, under the benches, in the dirt, and alive.
And the train had obviously had derailed, so it had stopped moving.
Yes, right. And the second time I thought we could die was when we saw that there was a fire somewhere, because we saw orange flames from underneath the car and smoke started filling the car. So I yelled to folks and said, stop trying to find your suitcases and get the hell out of here. We could all be asphyxiated.
Oh.
And so I'm not sure how many people we pushed out. We got out through the window to what was then the roof. I went looking for others to help. There was a woman behind me who wasn't as lucky. She had been crushed by the seat and wasn't moving, and I think died. And so I then got up myself, and Valen helped me get through the window, because although I didn't have a broken arm, it turned out I had broken ribs, but I was also without my glasses, rather blind. So, and then fortunately, when we were standing on what had been the left side of the car, but was now the roof of the car, the Philadelphia police arrived, and they came with ladders and said, don't try to get down. There's electricity here. Let us come and help you, which they did. And so they walked us across the tracks through the rail yard to a holding area, basically a piece of street at the side of the yard, and triaged us. People who were in really, really bad shape went out in ambulances. People who were in bad shape but less bad shape went out in police wagons, and those of us who thought we were in relatively good shape went last, and they got city buses and took us to a whole range of hospitals. I went to the Jefferson Hospital, where they first cleaned us up and gave me a tetanus shot, because had been bruised and it had all sorts of things, running through my skin.
Sure.
I was completely covered in dust.
Now, Josh, if you don't mind, let me just stop you there. I just need to quickly reintroduce you. That's Josh Gottbaum telling us about what happened on May 12th. He was a passenger on the now famous or infamous Amtrak train that derailed in Philadelphia. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. And Josh, something that you wrote in Politico, which is that you have had experience with disasters. And in many ways, did that prepare you for dealing with this particular disaster that you were a part of?
Well, it turns out there is a universe of difference between training for a disaster or helping people in a disaster and being the victim. And I was, I will say, the police, the fire, the passengers, none of us had prepared for a tragedy of this magnitude, and I thought people did amazingly well. Passengers, it wasn't every person for themselves. People helped each other. And given the fact that there was a fire in the car, they helped each other at a time when there was risk to them. The police and the fire came, scrambled, in my view, a good job. And the healthcare, I mean, the folks at the hospital that I went to, clearly were not prepared for anything like this. They did the best they could. The real surprise to me was actually Amtrak wasn't prepared.
Well, you know what? I want to, only because we have to take a very short break, and I do want to pick up on that and also get Jonathan Tamari back in on the conversation. We are talking with Josh Gottbaum. He's a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution in Washington. He was a passenger on Amtrak 188 that derailed in Philadelphia in May of last year. He's been describing the harrowing experience of being part of this derailment and what it took to get out of the train car that he was in. Jonathan Tamari writes for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Just a recap here. We've been talking about the derailment of Train 188. This was last May, on May 12th in Philadelphia, one of the worst accidents in Amtrak history. The train, as it turns out, was going twice the speed limit when it rounded a curve in the track, and within just a few seconds, it went off the rails. And our guest, Josh Gottbaum, on that train, has been describing the harrowing experience of being in the third train car of that train and what it was like to feel it and experience it going off the rails, and of course, what it took to get out of that train as well. The scenes of carnage, really horrifying. The NTSB released a trove of documents this week about the accident, including two interviews with the engineer Brandon Bostian. Jonathan Tamari, who's a Washington correspondent for the Philadelphia Inquirer, has read through a lot of those documents, and he's been talking about what's included and what the engineer did or didn't do or knew or didn't know. And again, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Any questions or comments? Josh, if you can just hold off 1 second, I want to turn back to Jonathan, because Josh Gottbaum has been describing in vivid detail what it was like for him to be on this train. And I wonder, from some of the interviews that you and others at the Inquirer have done, about some of the experiences of other passengers on the train and whether it kind of dovetails with what Josh has been telling us.
Yes, very much so. The common theme that you hear is that people are just going about their business. Lots of them are coming home from work at the end of a day, looking forward to what's going to happen next. One person I interviewed he loved to travel, and he was texting with his wife about where they might travel to next. And you hear people talking about this shaking and then feeling this gentleman, for example, the phone just flew out of his hands, and all of a sudden people are in the air and people are being thrown. Again, this has been described to us. And this person who I'm talking about, he now says he doesn't know when he'll be able to travel next because his injuries were so bad. And so you hear, and the crew interviews that are in these documents are very similar. People are doing their job, going about their business, and suddenly they're in the air, thrown across the train, and they come to, and the train has broken through equipment, and they awake in darkness because it's late at night.
frightening. And what you wrote, Josh, writing in Politico, was that this was a train full of good Samaritans. So what you saw was the best of humanity. We'll talk about Amtrak, but the best of humanity?
Oh, it was. I felt better about the world having been through this.
Wow.
Because people who didn't know each other helped each other. They could have just taken their bags and run. There was a fire, but they didn't. They helped each other. And the police and fire, who, although trained, I'm sure never trained for anything like this, they gave 110%. Same with the medical personnel. You felt better about the world because of the way folks responded after the disaster. I ran a charity after September 11th called the September 11th Fund. It was a very large charity co-founded by United Way and the New York Community Trust. And they opened their doors on the afternoon of September 11th, and they thought they'd raise $10, $20, $30 million. And they raised over $500 million. And the reason for that was people really wanted to help. And so one of the things I've learned is that when disaster happens, a lot of times what you see is people being kind of everyday heroes, doing what you would hope. And so I felt frankly much better about the world after having been through Amtrak 188. Now, the reason why I was disappointed in Amtrak is that was the one organization that should have been prepared. I ran Hawaiian Airlines for 2 years. I was a bankruptcy trustee. I got it out of bankruptcy. One of the things about airlines is airline personnel trained for disaster. They know what to do. Whereas, interestingly enough and sadly, Amtrak didn't. And so we went to the hospitals. We were taken care of by the hospital personnel. The first person I met from Amtrak was 6 hours after the accident. It was a person who came to the hospital. She said, "I can't answer any questions. All my job is to do is to put you in a taxi to go back to 30th Street Station, and people will talk to you there." And at 30th Street Station, there were 15 or 20 people from the American Red Cross, thank you, Red Cross, and two people from Amtrak. And they had a form which they'd apparently ginned up that night, so they were clearly not prepared for any of this stuff. They didn't have any answers to questions. They said, "Well, you can call customer service in the morning and get your questions answered." It was a very sad performance.
Well, let me
and
get...
it made me...
No, go ahead.
Anyway, And partly because I've spent part of my career in government, partly because I've spent part of my career in transportation, the fact that our national railroad just fell down at a time when it should have been compassionate and competent was depressing.
Let me go back to you, Jonathan. We got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. Now, Congress has looked at this accident, or certainly has looked at Amtrak and this section of the track. And even looking at this liability cap, it's a liability cap of, I think, of $295 million. Where does that stand?
So there's a liability cap that limits how much any railroad can be required to pay out in the event of an accident, and it did stand at $200 million prior to this accident, and there was a concern that it would not be enough for this crash. In late last year, they increased that amount to $295 million. So that is the maximum amount that could be paid out to the victims of people who were hurt, people whose family members were killed. That was seen as a victory for the victims, for the people who were hurt. Lawyers say that they don't know if it will be enough, but that it's an improvement over what it was. And that was largely done in response to this accident. Originally, it was proposed to go up to $500 million, but they increased it to $200. Let me correct myself. I think I said $290 to $295 million. And that was to adjust for inflation from when this limit was first put in place.
Do you or does anyone know how many lawsuits have been filed?
Dozens. There's a couple law firms in the Philadelphia area that have around 30, and then there are other law firms in other places that are also taking lawsuits. They've all been consolidated in a court in Philadelphia. And it's not clear yet how Amtrak is going to handle this. They've admitted their liability. There's still a question of, do they set up, sometimes you see funds set up that distribute certain payments based on the type of injury you have. You saw that after, for example, the Boston Marathon bombing. They basically set up a tiered system where if you had a certain level of injury, you got a certain dollar amount. It's not clear if that's going to happen in this case, or if there'll be some kind of broader settlement. That is all still working through the legal system. And if I could also just correct one other thing I said a little earlier, when we had the question about the speed on the curve. Amtrak's chief executive, Joseph Boardman, had told Congress that a train could get around the curve at just over 90 miles an hour, that that's the speed that a train could still navigate the curve at. Obviously, it was going even faster than that.
You mentioned liability. Is there any question about the engineer being liable, and what would that mean?
That is a big question about whether there could be some kind of civil suit or some other action related to him. And it's not clear yet what will happen. I think people are going to be very closely watching what the NTSB concludes is the probable cause of the accident to determine what, if any, kind of legal action he might face. And it's notable he did speak with Transportation Safety Board investigators who are not criminal investigators. He did not do a formal interview with the Philadelphia police.
And that's Jonathan Tamari joining us along with Josh Gottbaum. And we are talking about the derailment in Philadelphia May last year, the derailment of Train 188, one of the worst accidents in Amtrak history. The NTSB just released a bunch of documents this week about the accident. And the question still remaining about why the train was going so fast around this curve here in Philadelphia. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Josh, I do want to go back to you and Jonathan as well. Jonathan, you wrote about one of the conductors, a guy named Thomas O'Brien, and some of the actions of the conductors and others working for, I guess, Amtrak on that train and what they did under these circumstances. Can you speak to that quickly, Jonathan? And Josh, I'd like to get you to weigh in on that as well.
Mm-hmm. Sure. He was one of the stories that stood out. He was interviewed by the investigators, and he told about how he, after the crash, he checked himself and he felt, you know, he was winded, but he was overall okay. And his first instinct was to find his hat so that somebody would realize that there was somebody still in charge and he wasn't yelling orders. He wasn't a random person yelling orders, that somebody was trying to help and trying to figure things out. And he got himself up and went through the train, or described going through the train and trying to help people, trying to help them get out. So there are stories from crew members on the scene trying to help, as Josh has described, I think, passengers helping one another. The documents do not get into the kind of response he was talking about once they get to the hospital, once they get back to 30th Street Station.
And Josh Gottbaum?
I would draw a distinction. On a train, there are not a whole lot of personnel, of Amtrak personnel. And so I didn't see the conductors after the accident. I think there were two or three total, et cetera. The reason why I said I was disappointed was that after the accident, when there should have been training and preparation and people ready to do this, they didn't do that. After the accident, when there should have been phone calls or letters saying, "We're terribly sorry this happened," they didn't do that. And so the reason why I was disappointed in Amtrak is that even months later, there's never been an explanation, there's never been an apology. And I think when you are, first of all, when you are a service business, and second of all, when you're a government agency, that's what you do. You let people know you care. And you let people know that whatever went wrong that trip, it's never going to happen again, and you're going to make changes necessary to do that. As far as I can tell, at least to those of us who were on the train and were injured, Amtrak hasn't done any of that.
Wow. Let me read an email from Michael. He says, I instruct first responders for railroad accidents. Philadelphia's response to 188 was as close to textbook as I've ever seen. And Josh, I guess this gets back to the police, the ambulances, the fire.
The police, the fire, the ambulance people, they were great. They just were. And this was obviously more than people had trained for. So just to give you one little for instance, we now know 8 people who died, although we didn't have all of those. Something like 200 of us were injured.
Right.
And they had to triage 200 people. Well, my guess is that in first responder school, they probably don't actually tell you how to triage 200 people. And so what they did is they got some cards and they said to everybody, if you are severely injured, take this card. Or you see someone who's severely injured, take this card. It was one color. If you are less so, take another, et cetera, so that they could see by what card somebody was holding how bad they thought they were. And so they moved the first group out first, the second group out second, and the third group out on buses at the end. That wasn't training. That was being smart and being compassionate.
That's fascinating. Let me get Al from Upper Darby to join our conversation. Al, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Okay. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good discussion.
Thank you.
You said that the engineer had to run from New York to Washington, an hour and a half downtime, and to run back to New York. However, the train was a half an hour late, so he lost a half an hour of his resting period there. Was there any other indication of fatigue possibly being involved in this?
What was the word that you asked? What was your question again?
Was there any other indication
of fatigue?
I hear you. Possibly being involved?
Jonathan, looking at these NTSB documents, anything that would indicate fatigue?
He was asked repeatedly about that. He said he did not feel tired. He said that he slept 6 to 8 hours a night, that he had been sleeping normally, that he was in good health. This is what he told investigators. Again, obviously he has to have a concern about his own liability here as he's answering these questions, but he indicated that he was not tired, and he told them that he did no recollection of any kind of instances of insomnia or falling asleep unexpectedly or anything like that.
Josh Gottbaum, do you take this Amtrak train line? Have you taken it since May 12th?
Oh, many times. I'm actually back on it tomorrow. Let me put this in perspective.
Sure.
Okay, I've run transportation businesses. I've been in transportation. I've studied transportation. Rail transportation is, on average, the safest transportation we know. You are likelier to die taking the taxi on the way to the train station than you are on the train. And so this isn't about whether trains are safe, from my perspective. This is about figuring out what went wrong and making sure it never happens again, and making sure that the people who were affected are taken care of fairly. It doesn't mean we should all stop taking Amtrak, and it definitely doesn't mean that the Congress should, as they did like the week after, cut Amtrak's budget. This isn't about cutting Amtrak's resources. This is about improving Amtrak's management, improving Amtrak's compassion, and improving Amtrak's safety.
Well, on that note, to you, Josh Gottbaum, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times, and I'm glad you are okay.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Guest scholar at the Brookings Institution. Jonathan Tamari, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Washington correspondent for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for the newsletter, and catch us on satellite radio. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.